TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. From Fukushima to Solartopia, how the green-powered Earth Revolution can defeat King Kong, coal, oil, nukes, and gas. Only someone who worked tirelessly to defeat nuclear power for over 40 years and has not stopped to this day, someone who lived and built a renewable energy utopia for the same 40 years, can take the frightening topic of Fukushima and give energy for a way out. Harvey Wasserman says that we are in the fight for our lives. We must and can build the green-powered Earth before the next nuclear meltdown. In this Hiroshima Day 2014 speech, he lays out that it can be done. Harvey Wasserman lived on an organic farm in Massachusetts when he and his community prevented a nuclear power plant from being built in the Montague Valley in 1973. In 1976, he helped organize the Clamshell Alliance. They staged the first mass demonstrations against the Seabrook nuclear plant. In 1979, he co-organized MUSE, the Musicians United for Safe Energy concerts in Madison Square Garden. In 1994, he spoke for Greenpeace to 350,000 fans at Woodstock 2. To this day, Wasserman has investigated the nuclear industry and their meltdowns, from Harrisburg to Chernobyl and Fukushima. At the same time, he has taught history at Ohio colleges and has helped in successful campaigns to save a local wildlife refuge, shut a central Ohio trash-burning power plant, stop a regional radioactive waste dump, and ban McDonald's from his town of Bexley. Harvey Wasserman is writing articles for Counterpunch, The Huffington Post, and The New York Times. He's the author and co-author of a dozen books on nuclear history, war and peace, and renewable energy. Wasserman's Solartopia, Our Green-Powered Earth, is the first vision of a planet free from fossil and nuclear fuels. His website, solartopia.org, is the best link to his online activities and his weekly radio show on PRN, the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. I recorded Harvey Wasserman in the venerable meeting hall of the Unitarian Universalists Fellowship in Berkeley, California, on Hiroshima Day, August 6, 2014. Cecile Pineda, the Mexican-American author of Devil's Tango, How I Learned the Fukushima Step by Step, gave him an eloquent introduction. Cecile Pineda.
It gives me great displeasure to have to introduce Harvey Wasserman to you. I wouldn't have to be doing it if Enrico Fermi hadn't split the atom in 1934. I wouldn't have to be doing this if 12 hyped-up mathematicians at Alamogordo hadn't worked developing what they cavaliered referred to as JET. I wouldn't have to introduce Harvey if nuclear energy couldn't be profitable unless it provided bomb-grade plutonium to the atomic weapons industry. I wouldn't have to introduce Harvey if there weren't 7,315 nuclear bombs currently in the U.S. arsenal. And if, in a nod to austerity, the Pentagon wasn't planning on a bargain basement nuclear war slated for 2016, targeting Russia and possibly China. I wouldn't have to introduce Harvey if human negligence, deliberate criminality, and utter disregard for its dangers, human activity hadn't allowed more than 330,000 metric tons of nuclear waste to proliferate all over the planet, with no technology in sight to sequester it from the biosphere. So, Here we are on August 6, 2014, the 69th anniversary of the number one empires crossing the line in the sand and delivering the first two atom bombs on a civilian population. Although there were most likely more than just one smaller scale experiments conducted on its own people and in its own territories earlier, and many more would be scheduled later. So, let me stop here by sharing one small ray of light with you, this quote from Howard Zinn. To be hopeful in bad times is not just foolishly romantic. It's based on the fact that human history is a history not of cruelty, but also of compassion, sacrifice, courage, and kindness. What we choose to emphasize in this complex history will determine our lives. If we see only the worst, it destroys our capacity to do something. If we remember those times and places, and there's so many, where people have behaved magnificently, this gives us the energy to act, and at least the possibility of sending this spinning top of a world in a different direction. And if we do act, in however small a way, we don't have to wait for some grand utopian future. The future is an infinite succession of presents, and to live now as we think human beings should live, in defiance of all that is bad around us, it in itself is a marvelous victory. Harvey Wasserman has lived his life and dedicated his heart and mind to this spinning top for over 40 years. Please cheer this kind, compassionate, and courageous warrior, Harvey.
Harvey Wasserman began by extending personal greetings and thanks to Cecile Pineda and friends and fellow activists.
In my spare time, I edit a website called nukefree.org, N-U-K-E-F-R-E-E.org, which is supported by three of the greatest people that I've ever worked with, Bonnie Raitt, Jackson Brown, and Graham Nash. And I'd like to give them a round of applause. I really appreciate it. So much in the anti-nuclear movement has happened because of them. Where I am here now is to tell you good news, and then bad news, and then really good news, okay? So the good news is this: we're winning. We are definitely shutting down the nuclear power industry. It's definitely happened. From 1968 to 1984, I lived on a hippie farm in western Massachusetts. We had been there 5 years. We stopped burning the furniture. We figured out how to insulate the house and keep warm. And one day in December of 1973, the local utility company announced that they were going to build twin nuclear reactors 4 miles from our house. And in the local newspaper, there was an aerial photograph of the Montague Plains, which was where they were going to put it, and they superimposed a sketch, an artist's rendering of these nuclear plants. And the minute I looked at this, and all of us, we all looked at it instantly and said, we are going to stop this thing, and we are going to end any idea that they're going to bring the bulldozers into the Montague Plains. Now, we were given zero chance to stop these guys. We were just a bunch of hippies on the hill. The utility had come into the town expecting no opposition whatsoever. I mean, it was going to be jobs, tax breaks, excitement, all that great stuff. And we just said, no, we're not going to do it. And so that's when I remember the night I coined the phrase, no nukes. And then this guy from my farm, Sam Lovejoy, knocked over a weather tower as a protest. Some of you may know about. We made films. We organized. We wrote books. Anna Georgie wrote a wonderful book called No Nukes. And we just kicked him right out of town. They never got the bulldozers in. You can go to the place where they were going to build this thing and just lie down, and it's perfectly quiet, and there are birds flying over, and it's next to the Connecticut River, and we just won. Now, in 1974, Richard Nixon... Remember Richard Nixon? He announced in the middle of the Arab oil embargo that there would be 1,000 commercial reactors in the United States by the year 2000. 1,000. At the time he made this announcement, there were about 250 either online, under construction, or on order. And literally from the time he made that announcement, the numbers started to drop. Largely because of our movement in two directions. One, because of our political opposition. We cut off funding from the federal government, most of the funding, actually, that they would have gotten. And also, we started promoting renewables. And I'm going to talk about that in greater detail. Because of our movement, and don't let anybody tell you otherwise, we cut the number down. They never got over about 120 in the United States, which is way too many, but still an eighth of a thousand. In the year 2000, there were 104, not 1,000. Today, there are 100. We shut 4 reactors last year, including 2 at San Onofre between LA and San Diego. A huge victory. And so one of the things I'm here to urge is that all Californians, and I'm actually becoming a Californian, we still have Diablo Canyon. We have 2 reactors at Diablo Canyon. And I want to let you know that there is a really nice place to stay in San Luis Obispo. It's the county jail. I did 3 nights there. I plan on doing more. Back in 1984, we were the late in the day affinity group, and you know that those reactors will be shut. But it should be the number one priority. People ask me in California, what can we do out here? Shutting Diablo Canyon is a huge deal. It is in a tsunami zone, and it is surrounded by earthquake faults. It's the job of an organizer to make sure that people understand that you can win, and we've been winning for more than 40 years. Actually, in slowing this industry down. And I want to acknowledge one of the great heroes of our movement. I talked to Dennis about him on the radio today. A Bay Area, he wasn't a native, he was from Cleveland, but he lived out most of his life on Clayton Street in San Francisco, Dr. John Goffman. Dr. Goffman was at Lawrence Livermore. He was a genius, if there ever was one. Deserved 2 Nobel Prizes. He did some of the major pioneering work in LDL cholesterol. I never knew that until after he passed away. But he was also part of the Manhattan Project, and he co-discovered some of the isotopes that made nuclear weapons, unfortunately, and nuclear power possible. And he became the chief health officer of the Atomic Energy Commission. And in one of the most important acts of defiance and truthiness, I guess, as Stephen Colbert would say, in our history, I got to tell this story because, you know, this is Hiroshima Day. This is a major turning point. And very few people understood that commercial reactors could harm people back in the late 1960s, early 70s. But another great hero, and this man is still alive, Dr. Ernest Sternglass, was a radiologist at the University of Pittsburgh. And he got in the mail anonymously records of the radiation emissions from the Shippingport commercial reactor, which was the first to open in the world, actually, in 1957. And being a radiologist, he understood. He looked at the numbers, and he realized that Shippingport, even though it didn't have an accident, was killing people. He wrote a book called Secret Fallout, which was pulped, by the way. There, some very strange things happened to the copies of Secret Fallout. So when this came out, it was a big scandal, a big deal. And by the way, Ernie single-handedly, in many ways, stopped the anti-ballistic missile system. This was in the late 60s. Our plan, the genius American plan, was to put nuclear-tipped missiles around all of our cities. And if nuclear-tipped missiles were coming in, we would shoot nuclear-tipped missiles up and we would blow them up. And that was going to save us, right? So Ernie pointed out a small detail that if you did that, there'd be so much radiation that every child in the United States would basically keel over dead. And the article was published in Esquire, and actually it's generally credited with having turned Congress against the ABM system. And so when Ernie came out again and said that the nuclear power plants were going to harm people, or were harming people, they assigned Dr. Goffman, who was as prestigious a scientist as there was in the world, with his tremendous credentials from the Manhattan Project and all that other stuff. He was a medical doctor as well as a nuclear chemist. The head of the chief of the safety division of the Atomic Energy Commission, they said, go deal with this guy, expecting him to exonerate the nuclear industry. To John's everlasting credit and to the importance of our movement, he came back and said, well, you know, we've looked at this. He had a co-researcher named Arthur Tamplin from the RAND Corporation. They basically found out that nuclear power plants without an accident and with far fewer, far smaller reactors than we have today were killing 32,000 Americans a year. Now, the AEC wanted none of this, and they basically forced him out. They couldn't fire him. He was too prestigious. But they put him in a closet, basically. They took away his staff. They took away his funding. He published a book called Poisoned Power, which was ironically published, well, not ironically, fittingly published by the Rodale Press, the organic gardening and farming people. And we read Poison Power on our farm. And John, by the way, stuck with it for the rest of his life. I mean, he was unrelenting and absolutely an essential piece of the No Nukes movement. When he was asked what he thought of the nuclear power industry, remember, this is a guy at the top of the heap. He characterized nuclear power, and I quote, as premeditated mass murder. That's what he called the commercial atomic reactor industry. Now, when they came into our town to build this reactor, these two reactors, unfortunately, we already had an expert on the farm about nuclear power, which was me, because I had done a report on it in ninth grade, so I knew everything about atomic reactors, and I had got it out of Our Friend the Atom by Walt Disney, so good credible source there. But then we turned to John, we turned to Ernest, we turned to other sources, and we realized that atomic energy was already a failure, was killing people, was endangering people. All you really have to know about atomic power is that they can't get private insurance. Since 1957, I'm sure I'm not telling you anything most of you don't know, if there's an accident at a commercial reactor, the owners are not liable. How do you expect any safety, any public awareness, any public compliance from an industry that is not liable for what they do? And we're seeing this play out right now at Fukushima. Tokyo Electric Power Company built Fukushima. They own Fukushima. And they blew up Fukushima, all four reactors. And they still own Fukushima. We circulated a petition. I circulated this last summer and fall to go to the United Nations and ask the United Nations to set up a separate body to take over Fukushima and to put the experts there who could really clean this place up. We got 150,000 signatures. Move On helped, and Roots Action, and the Green Shadow Cabinet, and Greenpeace, and a few other organizations, 150,000 signatures. We took these signatures to the UN on November 7th last year. We have yet to get a reply. We have not heard a word from the United Nations. But the reality is that TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power, has no liability in this situation. Not only don't they have any liability, they're making money on this. Last year, Tokyo Electric Power showed a huge profit, mostly based on government money coming in to pay them to clean up the mess they made, of which they're completely incapable of doing. So let's talk about this. I'm going to go into the difficult phase of this talk. We'll get it out of the way, okay? And I pass out Prozac and Zoloft and other things to, but you know, this is hard stuff, and I'm just gonna have to tell you what's going on at Fukushima. It's not pretty, and it's very, very disturbing, but it's what we have to deal with, okay? So there were six reactors at Fukushima, 54 in Japan total. And the six reactors were very strongly opposed by the Japanese people. I was in Japan when they were building these reactors. I actually wrote an article that appeared in the Progressive magazine in 1977 about Fukushima. Not because I had any great sight wisdom, but people were marching. They said, what are you doing building commercial reactors in an earthquake zone washed over by tsunamis, which is, of course, a Japanese word. And they did every imaginable idiotic thing that you could, starting with the fact that the site where Fukushima was built had an 85-foot bluff on it. You know, 85 feet is a pretty decent, it's good to be above the sea level 85 feet if you got six commercial reactors that could be washed over by a tsunami, right? What did they do? They took down the bluff, because they didn't want the expense of pumping the seawater up 85 feet. So instead of sitting on the earth and operating these reactors in the air, which still would have been better, they just brought them down to sea level. And then they put the backup power source in the basement. Now, they built a flood wall, but there was historic data that the flood wall, that tsunami barrier was not high enough, that there had been historically tsunamis bigger than that. And the bottom line is this, that they put this thing right in harm's way. What has happened? Well, first of all, it may be that the earthquake itself caused the meltdowns anyway without the tsunami. This was a 9.0. It was a 9.0 120 kilometers away. God forbid it had been 12 kilometers away or 1.2 kilometers away. We would have had a pile of radioactive rubble. There would have been absolutely nothing that could have been done about it. And that could happen at Diablo Canyon. It could happen at Indian Point. Indian Point in New York is actually more susceptible, apparently, to earthquake than Diablo Canyon. And also, and this is the kind of thing you rarely think about, many of our commercial reactors in this country are downriver from large dams. And these dams are susceptible to earthquake damage, among other things. We have a dam upriver from the three reactors at Oconee in South Carolina, which has a 65-foot crack in it. And it is clear that if that, God forbid, that dam broke, the wall of water would exceed the tsunami that hit Fukushima in size. We've already had a reactor at Fort Calhoun, which we now call Port Calhoun, in Nebraska, which was flooded by the Missouri River a few years ago. So we've had experience with this already. This is not good news. At Fukushima, units 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, this is American technology. These are Mark I General Electric reactors. For more than 40 years, the nuclear power industry has been telling us that no commercial reactor can explode. Okay? Now, we had an explosion at Three Mile Island. We don't know how big it was, actually. And I'm going to have to do this. I'm going to tell a little aside here. At Three Mile Island, and this is part of our activist community here, at Three Mile Island there was a woman. When they built Unit 2, she got it in her brain that she was going to demand that the containment at Three Mile Island be able to withstand a jet crash. When you fly into Harrisburg, you fly right around this thing. She fought and fought and fought, and she won. She forced them to make the TMI containment dome the strongest one in the United States. And you know what happened? When the meltdown occurred, which they denied, by the way, they denied for years there was a meltdown of fuel. When the hydrogen explosion happened, it was almost entirely contained, thank God, by the containment dome. And we don't know to this day whether or not that woman had saved all of the northeast of the United States by forcing that containment. So don't ever think that this small deal that you're doing here or there, you know, doesn't have an impact. Chernobyl, they told us, when Chernobyl finally did explode, they said, well, it doesn't matter, that's a Soviet reactor, it couldn't happen in the United States. Now, let me tell you about Chernobyl. Chernobyl, you know, they put a sarcophagus over it. That thing is falling apart. They're trying to do another sarcophagus, another containment lid on it. It's the biggest structure ever made, by human beings. They're going to try and roll it on there on railroad tracks. You know, it's going to be happening over the next couple of years. Meanwhile, this thing is still putting out radiation. And we'll talk about the health effects in a minute. We'll do the engineering first. So then comes Fukushima. And after all these years of hearing American reactors can't explode, four of them exploded. Those are General Electric reactors. Units 1, 2, and 3, the core was in there. And all three of these reactors, all three of them melted into the ground. We don't know where they are. Now, this is my 41st year of fighting nuclear power. Nowhere before 2011 did we hear anything about multiple meltdowns. People always say, well, what if a commercial reactor melts? What if three melt, for God's sakes? They don't know where these cores are after all these years. And so what's happening is Fukushima is on the coast, and then you have the ocean, and then, as in virtually all of Japan, you have steep mountains. And, of course, water pours down the steep mountains on a regular basis. So you have essentially a river running through Fukushima. It's running by these reactor cores and becoming irradiated and pouring into the Pacific Ocean at the rate of 300 tons a day, and has been doing that since 3/11/11. There's no end in sight. The latest genius move that they've made, I'm sure you've all heard about, they want to build an ice wall, right? They want to stick freezer coils into the ground and have a frozen wall between the mountains and this river, and then divert the river around the reactor core. So far, they've got it all the way down to 57 degrees, and they've created a giant radioactive slushy over there. You know, they'll probably dump big cherry flavoring on it and just have a party. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's never going to work. And they were advised, by the way, early on to dig a trench and put in a special radiation absorbent material by Arnie Gunderson. They wouldn't do it because they said it cost too much. So now we have 300 tons of radioactive water pouring into the Pacific every day. And it may be detectable in California this summer, fall, we don't know. It is literally insane what they're trying to do there. And that's only part of it. Now, let's do more. The four explosions of Fukushima, units 1, 2, 3, and 4. In unit 4, the core had been lifted out before the tsunami came and before the earthquake hit. I mean, they were doing routine maintenance. Now, I couldn't make this up. In the General Electric Mark I reactors, the spent fuel pool is 100 feet in the air. Should I repeat that?
Yes.
In the General Electric Mark I reactors, the spent fuel pool is 100 feet in the air. I can't even begin to think what the way these guys were thinking. The reality is now you have a whole reactor core at Unit 4 up in the air. They have to get these down. But the fact is that they've been pulling these rods out, and now they say they're taking a three-month break. We think that they can't get them out. It stands to reason that some of them have warped and that there's debris in the pool. We don't know. We can't find out at this point in time. It's not a happy picture. And then units 1, 2, and 3 are also going to have, those spent fuel pools are also going to have to be emptied. God forbid they should lose coolant to one of those fuel rods. There's actually more radiation in the fuel pools than there is in the cores themselves. Okay? So that's the situation there.
That was the first part of a one-hour speech by Harvey Wasserman on how the green-powered Earth revolution can defeat King Kong, coal, oil, nukes, and gas. I recorded him in Berkeley, California, on August 6, 2014. Come back when TUC Radio returns to hear a laundry list of projects for the 100% renewable Earth. In over 40 years of anti-nuclear activism and green renewable energy practice, Wasserman has authored and co-authored a dozen books, countless articles for publications from Counterpunch to the New York Times. He teaches college-level history, does a weekly radio show on PRN, and has an active presence on the internet that you can access through his website, solartopia.org. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. TUC Radio has moved to Northern California. This program was produced off the grid with solar power. You can get information on how to order a CD at cost of the one-hour program by calling 1-707-463-2654. You can also place an order on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation on TUC's website keeps this program on the air. That's tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening.